Good evening, everyone. I would like to call to order this hearing of the Public Safety and Judiciary Conference Committee. Today is Friday, May 16th, and it is way too late in the evening to be doing this, but here we are. So we apologize to everyone who's been waiting and waiting for this conference committee to begin. Our fiscal staff are not here yet, but I thought we'd start anyway because there are other things we're going to do before we get to the walkthrough of the spreadsheet. But I just want to start by making a comment because this is the Judiciary Committee as well as the Public Safety Committee. And as you all know, the Judiciary Committee is kind of where we think about the larger issues of our Constitution and how we run here. And I just really want to start by making a comment that some of the reason that we are delayed this evening is that we've been waiting for members of the executive branch to approve our work here that we have done as a conference committee. This is not appropriate in my view. We all take an oath to uphold the Constitution, and the Constitution, as we know, has three separate branches of government. And I think we, as the Judiciary Committee, are very careful and respectful of the judicial branch, and they to us. But I think that there is a little bit of, I would say, leakage between the executive right now and the legislative branch. And the idea that we have an agreement and we have a global budget that's been reached between the executive and the legislative branch. Okay, well and good. I'm not commenting on that, although I have some opinion about that as well. But when we as a legislative branch do our work and come up with a spreadsheet and decide, you know, we've listened, we've talked to everyone, we've come up with work that we've done collectively as a legislative branch, I believe, and Chair Scott and I believe bipartisanly as the co-chairs of the Judiciary Committee that this is inappropriate. And I just really want to make that comment. This is starting to happen more and more. It's happened not just this year, but in recent years, that there is this what I consider inappropriate interference with the legislative prerogative from the executive branch. As we know, the governor has the power to veto any bill that he chooses. He can line item veto some items. But what we do here in the legislative branch, at the end of the day, we are making the decisions here and not the executive branch. So I just wanted to make that comment because here we are in perfect timing because now our fiscal staff has come. But we're going to go, first of all, we're going to turn to, let me just pause there. And even though we want to move forward, do any of the other members of the committee want to make any comment? I would be glad to have you comment on it as well, should you care to. And you may disagree with me even. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I wholeheartedly agree. There's no reason that the executive branch has to give some stamp of approval of what we do here before we can take up our bills. I find that greatly troubling. And I thank you for the words that you spoke earlier.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Chair Letts.
I will just add that I have no quarrel with the executive branch being involved in conversations and sharing with us what concerns they have and giving us input. And ultimately, it's their decision whether to sign what we propose or not. And I think it's good to have collaboration where we can have collaboration. But to give a veto power over everything before we've even got to the point of approving, that's what's troubling to me. So the prospect of going through this and making sure that we've got approvals from the executive branch before we're allowed to move forward with our budget proposals, I would agree that's quite troubling.
And,
let's just say we want to make sure the legislative branch remains independent. We have to make sure we stand up for our legislative branch prerogatives. So that's how this kind of government is set up to work. So I support the position you're moving toward there.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chair Letts. Okay, so let's move forward then with and get through this because it is quite late and we have some work to do here. So the first item, we have some outstanding policy items. So first, I would move adoption of the A38 amendment. This is one that we've discussed before. It started out as an amendment, a floor amendment, I believe, from Senator May Quaid, and with a lot of collaboration from various parties and vetting from agencies, we have come up with the language that is before you. And this is to try to get some control over data sharing that is going on with, or there's some concern about this possibly happening where data is being sent to registries, data from people with disabilities, lists of who has a disability, and so on. And so this is language that we've talked about it before, but the language before you has been worked on extensively, and we believe that we've gotten to a good place where we're minimizing unintended consequences. So any questions or discussion from members? All right, seeing none, Chair Latz? No, okay, seeing none. All in favor of adoption of the A38 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, the amendment is adopted. Next, I think Senator Seeberger has a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of Article 2, R5 through R7, Senate language lines 13.6 through 15.11. And this is a provision requiring the state fire marshal to conduct a third-party assessment of how firefighting services are provided in Minnesota. To include a review and analysis of incidents, incident types, response metrics, an analysis of the number of fire departments and types of staffing, effective response force of firefighters, recruitment, retention, training, certification, and to deliver their findings once that is completed.
All right. Thank you, Senator Seeberger. Senator Seeberger is moving adoption of Article 2, R5 to 7, the firefighting service study. Is there any discussion to the motion? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Latz. Oh, did you have a motion? Okay.
Ah, yes, I do. I move adoption of Article 11, R12, Senate language, starting on line 169.27, as amended by the A46. This has to do with access to the unredacted portable recording system data related to collision investigations, giving authorization for that to be shared, and in particular, focusing on dash cam as well. The A46 amendment exempts the state patrol from having to disclose the unredacted portable recording system data and also puts some guardrails around the use of that data once it has been disclosed to the requesters. The requesters are already limited in statute as to who can get it, insurance companies, for example, attorneys representing claimants, and so on. But there was some additional concern about requesters disseminating or using the data in a manner that would not be appropriate. So we do put guardrails in the sense that a requester who disseminates or uses the data would be subject, in violation of the restrictions, would be subject to the remedies in the Data Practices Act under Chapter 13, and also a notice requirement so that when they are given the data, they are informed that if they disseminate it without proper authorization under the law, they could be subject to those penalties. This does not restrict the lawful use of that data, however. So when it's used as part of a claims evaluation or pursuit of a lawful claim, it becomes public data as it would under any circumstance anyway, and it would not invoke the sanctions in Chapter 13.
All right, thank you, Senator Latz. Is there any discussion to the amendment? All All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of Article 11, R12, as amended by the A46 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment, and the section and the amendment are adopted. So now we will go to a walkthrough of the spreadsheet and an overview of the leadership agreement that impacts the targets. So who's going to start here? Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, members, I'll do the judiciary part of the spreadsheet. And I'd like to start by saying that the committee had targets of for fiscal year 26-27, $19,163,000.
And Mr. target. Turner, can you get any closer to your microphone?
Sure. Fiscal year 26-27 net target was $19,163,000. Fiscal year 28-29 target was $54,822,000. For fiscal year 26 and 27, the way we got to that target of $19 million was with $43.4 million in appropriations, offset by $17.7 million in fiscal year 25 cancellations, and $6.5 million in ongoing fee increases. I'll go, I guess, agency by agency real quick. We'll start with the Supreme Court on line six. And I'm not going to mention the bases. I'll just mention the decision items. On line six is insurance and compensation. The conference committee appropriated $1,533,000 each year in fiscal year 26 and 27 to the Supreme Court for insurance and compensation. It has tails of $1,757,000 each year in 28 and 29. For the Board of Civil Legal Aid on line 19, a general operating increase, which is titled insurance and compensation here. For the board, the committee appropriated $1,186,000 each year ongoing for the 4 years. For the Court of Appeals, on line 27, the committee appropriated $365,000 each year the first 2 years, with tails of $535,000 in 28 and 29. Oh, excuse me. Under the Supreme Court, we missed one of the few non-operating cost items. On line 12, we have the conference committee appropriated $4 million the first year, one time, for the Justice Partner Access program. So then we move to the district courts. Line 37, insurance and compensation. Conference committee appropriated $9,620,000 in 26, $9,621,000 in 27, with tails for the courts of $17,035,000 each year in 28 and 29. Then we have a Senate-only provision which became a conference committee position, forensic exam rate increase from $136 per hour to $165. The cost of that came in at $2,685,000 each year ongoing. Page two, we have guardian ad litem. We have an operating adjustment, insurance and compensation of $892,000 each year for the first 2 years, tails of $1,502,000 each year, 28 and 29. For the tax court, the committee appropriated $41,000 in 26, $82,000 in 22nd and subsequent. Uniform Laws Commission, the committee appropriated the base amount of $115,000 each year ongoing. For the Board of Judicial Standards, the committee appropriated $9,000 in each of fiscal year 26, 27, with tails of $15,000 in 28 and 29. On line 80, Public Defense Board operating increase. The committee appropriated $3,262,000 each year in 26 and 25, with tails in 28 and 29 of $5,469,000. Then we have the Human Rights Department. On line 80, we have the insurance and compensation line $155,000 first year, $314,000 second, and subsequent. $314,000 is straight tails. Then we have a house-only provision, which the conference committee adopted, would save $216,000 each year ongoing, reduced trends reporting. I believe that the department brought that up, brought that to the House and to the Conference Committee. Then on, we have the Office of Appellate Counsel and Training. The committee had a base cut to the office of $560,000 in 26 and $199,000 in 27 and subsequent years. We have the Competency Attainment Board at the top of page 3. Operating adjustment of $117,000 the first year, $237,000 second and subsequent. Then we have the Cannabis Expungement Board, operating adjustment of $7,000 first year, $22,000 second and subsequent. And then we have the committee made an $18,000 appropriation to the Secretary of State to fund the cloaking of judicial property records. Then I'll quickly go over the cancellations that I mentioned earlier. They start on line 124. Fiscal year 24-25, appellate counsel for parents cancellation of $2 million. It's booked in fiscal year 26. Cannabis expungement board on line 125, cancellation of one-time cancellation of $6,700,000. And then competency attainment board cancellation fiscal year 24-25 appropriation of $9 million. Then we have two permanent fee increases. The civil court filing fee increase is $25, I think from 285 to 310. Brings in $2,495,000 each year ongoing. And then we have a $25 motion fee increase from $75 to $100 that brings in $765,000 each year ongoing. That, Madam Chair, brings us to the sub-target totals. As you can see, the conference target, $19,163,000. We net out at that for fiscal year 26-27 and $54,822,000 in 28-29. That's judiciary.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Mr. Walls.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John Walls, House Fiscal Analysis. Public safety portion begins on line 40, but I would first say that the target for the public safety portion was $88,260,000 in 26 and 27. And in 28-29, that number dropped to $57,257,000 for the tails. As part of the global agreement between all parties, the operating adjustments that the governor had suggested for his agencies was required to be funded in all of the bills. And so of our $88 million target, $73 million was reserved for the operating adjustments suggested by the governor. That left $14,600,000 for the committee to spend on optional items unless we created other dollars to save to boost that spending. So I'll start by saying that I'm not going to go over the operating adjustments. They're on the spreadsheet, and you can see them. I'm just going to walk through and highlight the discretionary items that the committee funded. So beginning on line 40 for sentencing guidelines, there was just the operating adjustment. We moved to public safety. And in the program area of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, you can see on line 156, we included Senate File 7734, which was supplemental nonprofit security grants, at $125,000 for 2 years and with no tails. In the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, there was the operating adjustments suggested by the governor, but also you'll see the inclusion on lines 171 and 172 of the moving in of several positions from the Department of Commerce to make up the state fraud and financial crime section within the BCA. Under, beginning on line 181, for the fire marshal, we included the governor's initiatives, and this is all special revenue fund. There's the operating adjustment, the move-in of the urban search and rescue, and hazardous materials response. You can see on line 189 the inclusion of House File 764, statute of limitation on arson, which has been increased to a 10-year statute of limitations. In the Board of Firefighter Training, we have essentially Governor's Rec, which takes us to the top of page 5. Gambling and alcohol enforcement, we have the Governor's recommended operating adjustment. In Office of Justice Programs, we included two provisions. On line 221, the inclusion of Senate File 2291, Prosecutor Training Grant, that is $100,000 per year for 2 years. On line 223, we included Senate File 1835, which is legal representation of children. That is also $100,000 a year for 2 years. Moving down to 235, which is the program area of emergency communication networks, we included the governor's suggestion of $14 million from the E911 fund for armor maintaining critical infrastructure. Madam Chair, that takes us to the top of page 6. There was no inclusion of the Senate Ignition Interlock provision because that traveled in a different bill. There, on line 253, there are the totals for public safety. Moving down to line 264, peace officer standards and training, we have the governor's operating adjustment, and on line 268 for the Philando Castile Training Fund. The bill provides $4,942,000 per year for 26 and 27, and ongoing tails of $878,000 beginning in 28 and thereafter. On the Private Detectives Board, we have the governor's suggested operating adjustment. Moving down to corrections for incarceration and pre-release services, we have the agency requested adjustments on line 287, and on line 289, you can see the savings for the phased closure of the correctional facility in Stillwater, which is $61,500,000 in the 26-27 biennium and $91 million in 28 and 29. On line 293, we have the inclusion of Senate File 1719 Mandatory Minimums Task Force, and that is $133,000. That is one time in fiscal year 2026. And on line 296, you can see the bed impact of fentanyl exposure of a child. Madam Chair, that brings us up to the top of page 7, community supervision and post-release services within the Department of Corrections. On line 305, we have the acceptance of a governor's suggestion to eliminate the sentence to serve program and the savings that are recouped from that closure. On line 310, organization and regulatory and administrative services within the Department of Corrections, we have the governor's suggested adjustments. On line 23, Ombudsman for Correction, we have their requested operating adjustment. On line 334, the same for the Clemency Review Commission. On line 345, we have a transfer into the Victims of Crime account. The committee settled on a number of $7,232,000 on a one-time basis in fiscal year 2026. But in 2028 and every year thereafter, there will be a statutory transfer of $878,000 from the general fund into the Victims of Crime account. Also deposited into that account is line 349, and these are revenues from increased fees and fines for marriage license and certain criminal penalties. That brings us to the top of page 8. On line 354, there is a $1 million decommissioning study to the Department of Corrections. On line 359, there is $250,000 to the Office of Higher Education, and that is for in-service use of force training. Moving down to line 371, we had three separate appropriations that were set to expire, and there was language included that would extend those. That was $2.5 million for the Chippewa Tribe Coast Guard Services. On line 374, it was $5 million for Ramsey County Juvenile Placement Homes. And on line 376, Peace Officer Death Benefit for $1,275,000. On line 378, we have a cancellation from a prior bonding bill of $1 million from DOC Asset Preservation. These were the funds that were used to fund the decommissioning study. Madam Chair, those essentially are the items in the bill. You can see on line 381 and to 395 the subtotals for the public safety portion, and page 9 are the totals for the entire bill, and I would stand for any questions.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Wall. So do members have any questions on the spreadsheet? And we're going to, just so you know, we're going to release our fiscal staff after this so that they can go and do the work they have to do. So any questions? Mr. Turn.
Yes, Madam Chair, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment.
Please.
On page 6, John and I have been working with various spreadsheets all day, and I think we have a title that is from a spreadsheet from bygone times. And it's a fairly important one, so I want to point it out. On line 287, it reads net agency-wide operating adjustment with MCF Stillwater phased closure. That is simply the incarceration and pre-release services operating adjustment. It's not net agency-wide. So, and that title was from a spreadsheet from a long time ago, like just hours ago. So anyway, that's an important thing. If our friends in corrections saw that, I think they would be upset. So I wanted to point that out.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Turner. Any questions about that or anything else, members? All right. Not seeing any. So thank you very much for the walkthrough. So fiscal staff, I think you could be excused and go and do the other things that you need to do. Thank you. All right, now we're going to take testimony on the agreement, and we have Chief Justice Natalie Hudson, who's been waiting patiently for hours. Thank you very much. And State Court Administrator Jeff Shorban, if you would please come up and welcome, and please go ahead and give us your testimony. And you do need to, I'm sure you know, just state your name for the record, if you would.
Good evening. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening, chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Natalie Hudson, and I have the honor of serving as Minnesota's Chief Justice. I'm here today on behalf of the 322 judges and approximately 2,800 staff who serve in the Minnesota Judicial Branch. And I just want to say I do appreciate the opportunity to appear before you here this evening. Let me begin by just expressing my sincere appreciation to the House and Senate Judiciary Committees for your thoughtful work throughout the session, and to the members of this conference committee for your efforts to reach agreement under very difficult circumstances. I know well that this has been a challenging year with difficult choices and limited resources. And I understand that this is a session where no one will get everything that they had hoped for, and that shared sacrifice is certainly a reality across the state government. At the same time, though, I want to emphasize what I believe is a shared value across all branches of government, and that is the importance of a strong, fair, and accessible justice system. Our courts are not simply another government program. They are an essential part of our democracy. They protect constitutional rights, including the rights of everyone in this room and those and the citizens across the state of Minnesota. They ensure the rule of law for everyone in this room and for the citizens across the state of Minnesota. They resolve disputes peacefully for everyone in this room and for our citizens across the state of Minnesota. And every day, thousands of Minnesotans rely on our courts to assure safety, access to justice, and fairness. Minnesota's judiciary has long been recognized as one of the most innovative, efficient, and well-managed court systems in the nations. That is not a boast. It is a recognition that is earned through decades of careful stewardship, continuous improvement, and a long-standing tradition of collaboration and mutual respect among the three branches of government. The conference agreement before you includes funding for several important priorities for our judiciary. It addresses certain unavoidable costs facing our courts, including rising health insurance expenses and increased lease costs at the Minnesota Judicial Center. It provides a pay rate increase for forensic psychological examiners, an important step in addressing rising demand for timely evaluations in criminal and civil commitment matters. And it provides one-time funding to help us develop a new justice partner access system to increase information sharing throughout our justice system. And we are grateful for these investments. We truly are. But even with these investments, the agreement before you today does not meaningfully address what remains the most urgent and unsolved challenge facing our courts, and that is ensuring that we have the judges and staff required to carry out the work of justice in communities across Minnesota. Without them, we cannot fulfill our constitutional responsibilities or meet the needs of Minnesotans who turn to us every single day. As we have detailed for you throughout the legislative session, our judicial branch compensation structure already lags behind the rest of the public sector in Minnesota, and our courts are routinely now seeing employees take higher paying positions in local government or state agencies. Although the bill does provide modest compensation increases for court employees, much of that is one-time funding that cannot be used for permanent salary adjustments. This means we will spend the next 2 years falling further and further behind. And without a stable, well-supported workforce, our ability to provide timely access to justice will be at serious risk. Even more concerning, this bill leaves judicial salaries frozen for the next 2 years, at a time when we are already seeing serious warning signs about our ability to attract strong candidates to the bench. As we've shared with you throughout the legislative session, the Commission on Judicial Selection has reported a troubling decline in qualified applicants for open judgeships, particularly in Greater Minnesota. Over the past decade, applicant pools have dropped by nearly 50%. Just this year, the governor's office was forced to extend application deadlines for vacancies in both the 9th and the 6th judicial districts due to a lack of applicants. When judicial service is no longer a viable or competitive option, we risk diminishing the quality, experience, and diversity of the bench, and with it, the public's trust in the strength and fairness of our courts. The judges and staff of the Minnesota Judicial Branch are public servants in the truest sense of that word. They serve with integrity, empathy, and excellence, supporting the rights and needs of over 1 million court users a year. We have over 1 million cases that are filed in the district courts around this state. They are the backbone of our judiciary and the reason Minnesota enjoys one of the most respected court systems in the country. They deserve your support. And the people of Minnesota deserve the high quality and effective system of justice that these individuals deliver. Before I conclude, I do want to respectfully share a concern about the process that led to the judicial branch's budget target. While I understand that this committee did not set the original target, It is important to note that the judicial branch was not consulted at any point in that decision-making. We were not part of the conversation about what this level of funding would mean for our operations, our workforce, or the services that we provide. As a co-equal branch of government, we must be meaningfully included in decisions of this magnitude, especially when those decisions will determine our ability to deliver justice and fulfill our constitutional obligations over the next 2 years. The courts are not a luxury. We are not a it's nice to have. We are a constitutional. The courts are a constitutional obligation. They are a pillar of democracy. Without the courts, we have chaos. And we cannot have that. Failing to invest in the courts is not just a budget decision. It is a decision about the kind of justice system that Minnesotans will have. If we want a system that is timely, fair, and worthy of the public's trust, it must be staffed, resourced, and supported accordingly. Anything less jeopardizes the foundation on which our courts and our democracy stand. I thank you for your time, your attention, and your service on behalf of the people of Minnesota. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. I know you all know Jeff Shorba, our state court administrator, and together we'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Justice Hudson. And we certainly appreciate your appearance here today, and I appreciate your words, and take them to heart. And do members of the committee have any questions or comments that you would like to make? Chair Lance.
Madam Chair and Chief Justice, thank you for your words. I wish I could tell you that this broadcast was being listened to in the office of the governor and in the office of our Senate and House legislative leaders that apparently completely failed to consult with the judicial branch in deciding what our targets would be for this conference committee. That was a grievous oversight. We spent hours and hours in rooms with the heads of the Department of Corrections and the Department of Public Safety. Both commissioners are sitting here today. And as you already heard, we had to get approvals per that leadership agreement for our spreadsheet before we could move forward to adopt this conference committee report. I was not asked for specific input on a number for the judicial branch appropriations either. And I'd be surprised if any of the other chairs on this committee were asked for that input. And I could not have said any better than what you said about the importance of our justice system. Ironic, when we live in a day of threats to democracy and the rule of law and the role of the executive in relationship to that rule of law, it was just revealed that what was thought to have been a copy of the Magna Carta that was in the possession of the Harvard Law School Library was in fact an original from the year 1300. One of only seven such originals known to be in existence. The Magna Carta was originally written in, I think, the year 1210, when the barons convinced then King John in England to concede some of his power and recognize some of their rights. It was partially retracted and then reissued by Henry III and then followed up by the king that followed Henry III. And among the rights of the Magna Carta, which became part of the foundation of our United States and Minnesota constitutions, was a principle that there would be no deprivation of rights except by rule of law or the decision of one's peers. I hope this sounds familiar to the people in this room. And the only way in which those rights are adequately, meaningfully enforced is by the society's consensus that they are important and an agreement to follow them. As the judicial branch has no formal enforcement mechanism, they rule by the power of their words and the agreement of society that this is how we are going to live in democracy. And it is an essential check on the power, yes, of the legislature and also, particularly, of the executive branch. So the funding, which serves to allow the branch to function and to attract the very best jurists and staff to implement that justice system, is absolutely critical. And while we are in a position here where we have to work within the confines that we were given by our leadership, I share your disappointment in those confines. And I will pledge to continue to work to find better ways to address the judicial branch's needs as we move forward. Thank you for your words and for your work.
And thank you, Senator Latz. I certainly appreciate that, and I look forward to continuing to work with you and with this body to strengthen the judiciary. And so thank you for those words. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Any other members that wish to speak? Have questions? Okay. All right. Well, thank you again.
Thank you, Chair Lieberman.
Thank you for your patience as well as we work through this long process. Okay, next on my list I have Devin Bruce. Welcome to the committee, and I apologize that we've made you wait so long. We're going to have to ask you to be somewhat brief, however, because we do have a lot to get to. But welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Devin Bruce. I'm the Director of Legislative Affairs for MAPE. I just want to make a couple comments on some of the provisions. First, the operating adjustments for the agencies. These are pretty vital for making sure that our staff remain employed and can deliver the essential services in both the corrections, DPS, BCA crime lab down the line. We would also like to voice our support for language that's currently in the A43 amendment regarding the human services appeals judges and classifying their personal data. This was largely an oversight when the OAH had their administrative law judges have personal information classified as private, while also the human services judges are also administrative law judges, just not under that court system. Finally, we'd like to first comment a little bit on the closure of Stillwater. And I think you'll hear a little bit more of a theme of the failure to consult, the failure to collaborate, also in my remarks. The process that we're witnessing today for the closure for Stillwater Correctional Facility is just utterly disappointing and completely adverse to the original intent of the underlying statute that requires legislative approval before closing the facility. The statutory provisions were to ensure a thorough and public vetting that can be done prior to a closure and done through the committee process. And with this agreement, as negotiated by the legislative leaders as well as the governor, and the announcement just made yesterday, we are throwing that out. Numerous times, Commissioner Schnell has assured us and our members that they had no plans to close the prison prior to the completion of the decommission study, which is also in the A39 amendment, so that there would be an orderly transition of both staff and the incarcerated population. But here we forge ahead with a bifurcated process. For Stillwater, we build the plane while we fly it, initiating transfers and closures prior to the production of the report, while future contemplated closures will have some study that is required. And while I recognize that the language reflected in the A39 is the committee's effort to assuage our concerns prospectively, the actions by the administration and leadership show that codifying this language has little worth if they can just wipe it out completely during the closure. And this says nothing about the impacts of the downstream and collateral effects on programmatic, therapeutic, and rehabilitative staff that now have to take on additional casework. We appreciate the time. Thank you much.
Thank you for your testimony. Do members have questions for the testifier? All right, seeing none, thank you. Next we have Ethan Vogel. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, what a pleasure to be here.
The pleasure is ours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, for the record, my name is Ethan Vogel. I serve as Legislative Director with AFSCME Council 5, and we respectfully request that this conference committee reject the provision of the leadership agreement to close the Stillwater Correctional Facility within the next 4 years. And we urge you to go back and find the money, the resources necessary to fully staff our state correctional system. Moving forward with the closure of the state's second largest correctional facility without a concrete plan in place is really quite dangerous and irresponsible. And that's all we want to know is, like, what is the plan? Our members keep asking us and we don't have an answer. The incarcerated population at Stillwater, roughly 1,200 people, of those, 579 sentences for homicide, 470 plus sentences for assault or domestic assault. There are 248 criminal sexual conduct sentences, misconduct sentences. My point is, this is a very challenging and dangerous population, and if your plan is to move forward without a plan and quickly mix them into the other facilities' populations, we're going to see a negative impact on outcomes. And the other point is that this population at Stillwater is accustomed to single cell, being single celled in their wet cells, and it might seem trivial to have a toilet and a sink in your cell, but it is a preferred amenity. And I guess the concern is if we don't have the capacity in other facilities to ensure an equivalent accommodation, you know, we think this is going to lead to overcrowding. It certainly will, and it's going to make every other facility less safe. And people who are in Stillwater, they are murderers, they are rapists, they are child abusers, and they have assaulted correctional staff in order to get to Stillwater. So what happens if over the next 4 years we have a limited number of single cell options, but that is where the Stillwater population wants to be? This population will, over the next 4 years, assault our members in order to jump to the top of the list and get themselves placed in Oak Park Heights. This is very dangerous thing that you all are setting up when you vote for this, if you vote for this. They'll attempt to avoid double bunking in other facilities or dorm style room situations, and my fear is that our members are going to be severely hurt. And again, we shouldn't be moving forward when we don't know what the proposed plan is, and the legislature certainly should not abdicate their responsibility. They should maintain some oversight in this. And, like, God forbid if somebody gets killed or if somebody gets seriously injured during this transition, because in the last 24 hours, you all decided to move forward quickly and without a plan and behind closed doors and without any real opportunity for engagement or for feedback, the blood will be on your hands for making this decision. And I don't want that to happen. I don't want us to be here years later saying, maybe we should have listened to the workers. maybe we should have listened. And so to echo Mr. Bruce's points, on page 3 of your A39 amendment, lines 17 to 19. So the plan, which we're going to put on paper, that's great. The plan must minimize staff layoffs and maximize opportunities for staff of the facility designated for closure to transfer to vacant positions in other correctional facilities. What vacant positions are we talking about here? We've heard the commissioner say we're 99% fully staffed. So what vacant positions are we talking about? So we have hundreds of members right now on probationary status. So what is the plan? Is the plan to cut them loose, to non-certify them, to fire them? So we protect against layoffs, but there's no verbiage in here protecting against non-certifications in order to open up positions for the Stillwater workers to fill. It's a terrible proposal. It's half-baked. It's jeopardizing safety across all of corrections. It's jeopardizing outcomes. And we all know that Stillwater someday is going to close. Without significant investment, Stillwater will shut down. But this is not the way to move forward. It's not the way to do it. And it's simply time to take a step back and create a real plan with legislative approval and legislative oversight and an opportunity for stakeholder engagement and feedback. And in the meantime, for you all to go back to leadership and renegotiate this budget and find more money so that we can fully staff our state correctional facility while we create a plan. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Members, any questions or comments for Mr. Vogel? All right, thank you. Next we have Hannah Wind. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Hannah Wind with Cozen O'Connor Public Strategies here on behalf of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We'd first like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today and to share our appreciation for the Philando Castile Memorial Training Funding allocation of $9.8 million listed on the spreadsheet. As you know, since 2017, the fund has historically been funded for $3 million in the base and then $6 million each year. We acknowledge the difficult decision that the chairs have had to make with the budget constraints that are coming up in the years, and this allocation demonstrates the legislature's commitment to quality policing in our communities. Fully funding the training was the chief's number one legislative priority for this year in order to have training reimbursements for local law enforcement agencies to have their officers be continually in compliance with the state's mandates. The association supports these requirements, and we believe they are important for upholding the highest standard of policing and that they play a significant role in developing and maintaining relationships in our communities. We thank you for the appropriation, and we look forward to working with members of the committee in the coming sessions in effort to fully fund the $6 million for each year. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for members or comments? Right, not seeing any. Okay. All right, we will move on then to adoption of some additional items that are related to the finance portion of the bill. And on my list here, I have first Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of Article 2, R2, Senate language, lines starting at 10.4, and as amended by the A40 amendment. Madam Chair, this motion, this language has to do with the nonprofit security grants. We are providing one-time money of $125,000 each year. My understanding is one of the primary points of the amendment is that it provides for the eventuality that if FEMA happens to not fund things or goes by the wayside, this provides a mechanism for the state to receive and process applications. And that is primarily the amendment and the language.
All right. Thank you, Senator Westland. So moving Senator Westland's moving adoption of Article 2, R2, the Senate language starting at line 10.4 as amended by the A40 amendment, correct? Is there any discussion to the proposed, to the motion? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Representative Scott, did you have a motion?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move adoption of House language lines 88.23 through 89.16 on page R13, A11, and lines 90.1 through 98.12 on page R17, A11. I also move adoption of the A43 amendment. This is the language of the Judicial Branch and District Judges Association proposed to protect judges' real property records. And the amendment incorporates stakeholder feedback and adds protections against dissemination of personal information for Department of Human Services judges. What the A43 does is on line 1.14, it clarifies that current and retired justices are included in the definition of judicial officials. Line 1.5 adds judges and employees in the DHS Appeals Division to the definition of judicial officials. Lines 1.7 to 111 and lines 1.15 to 2.6 makes changes requested by the County Recorders and Bar Association. Lines 1.12 to 1.14 exclude judges and employees of the DHS Appeals Division from the real property records provisions. And lines 2.7 to 2.19 adds an amendment requested by the District Judges Association that was adopted on the Senate floor to the House language.
All right. Thank you, Representative Scott. So is there any... I'm not going to repeat the lines and all of that unless anyone needs me to do that. Is there any, are there any questions? Chair Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could I get a clarification from staff? There's some references here to employees in DHS. Can you put this into context for me, what how the employees are being addressed in here, because in the other judges' real property protections, my recollections, we're only doing it for the judges, not for the staff. But maybe I can get a clarification on that.
Okay, Ms. Primo.
Madam Chair and members, the employees and judges of the DHS Appeals Division are being added to the general definition of judicial officials that's used under current law. But they are being excluded, judges and employees of the DHS Appeals Division are being excluded from the real property provisions which are being created in this bill, because that I believe that was part of an agreement to include them for purposes of current law related to judicial data, but not for purposes of the real property records.
Chair Lentz?
Okay, so the way we're treating district court judges, are their employees, are there the staff in those divisions, are they subject to the other privacy protections?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the general definition for judicial officials, it is somewhere in our bill, and maybe it would be helpful to look at that language. And yes, under current law, employees and judges of the judicial branch receive all of the current law privacy protections. Gotcha. But for real property records, only those judges do and not the employees of the judicial branch.
Okay. Appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments to the motion? All right. Does anyone need me to repeat the motion? No, I'm not seeing a great demand for that. All right. All those in favor of the motion by Representative Scott, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the section and the amendment are adopted. Okay, let's see. Okay. Chair Latz, you have a motion.
Madam Chair, I move adoption of House language lines 5.11 to 5.14 on page R5A1. And I'd like to make an oral amendment as well. On page R5A1, line 5.12, before the word fee, insert the word reasonable. Members, this language allows the judicial branch to charge a fee to private attorneys for improved access to court documents and information created by this provision. This is part of the Justice Partners access to court records provisions. And the amendment would just state that any fee that is charged needs to be a reasonable fee. And since lawyers love the word reasonable, we had to find a way to put it in there somewhere.
All right, and we certainly would not want the fee to be unreasonable.
Correct.
Absolutely. So thank you for that. So any discussion to the motion? Senator Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only question that is, who is going to be the arbiter of what is reasonable?
The judge is setting the fee.
That's right. So, right, we recognize the judicial branch is going to have control over this. This is simply our sending them our intention that the fee be reasonable. So, all right, any other questions or comments to the motion? All right, all in favor of adoption of the motion by Senator Latz, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. And that section with the amendment is adopted. Okay. Representative Moeller, you have a motion.
I do, Madam Chair. I move adoption of the A39 amendment, and I do have an oral amendment. On page 1, line 10, delete December 31 and insert September 30. And then I'll just kind of, since this is the amendment related to the phase closure of Stillwater over the course of 4 years and it's not in the underlying bill language, I'd like to just take a minute to walk through what this amendment does.
Please.
All right, so the first, on the first page is an appropriation for the decommissioning study. And with the oral amendment, we're moving up the timeline of that study. And while it does allocate $1 million for that, as Mr. Walls explained when we did the walkthrough of the spreadsheet, they're just taking, they've got the money from a different source. And so it's actually a budget neutral item to us this year. So that's for the actual decommissioning study. And then if you look on line 2.27, that is what's in current statute about the legislative approval for the closure of either Stillwater or St. Cloud. And so the Stillwater language is stricken from this on line 2.27. And then if you move to line 3.16, this is not necessarily specific to Stillwater, but it will apply to Stillwater as well, requiring the commissioner to develop a written plan for the closure and then all of the different things that the written plan must take into consideration. And then finally, on line 3.29, that paragraph there, which is specific to Stillwater, is just making it clear that because of this phase closure, that doesn't mean that anybody's going to get any special early release or reduction of sentence just as a result of this closure. So I'm happy to answer questions about this amendment as well if anyone has any.
All right, and thank you, Chair Moeller. And I should just say that the amendment, the oral amendment, I think we just incorporate that.
Right.
I don't think we have to vote on it separately. So we'll just incorporate your oral amendment on line 1.10, changing the date from December 31st to September 30th. Is there discussion to the amendment? All right, not seeing. Yeah, I'll go to Chair Scott and then I'll go to Chair Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had a question for the Commissioner
if he's willing to come to the table, since he's here at this late hour.
He's here. We should make use of his presence. Yes. Welcome, Commissioner. Please go ahead and state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Paul Schnell, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections.
Thank you. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Just wondering, I don't think that you've probably, in fact, I know you've not been a part of a decommissioning of a prison before in your role here, but can you walk us through that process a little bit? I think it's pretty new to everyone, what that might look like.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Scott, the decommissioning study would be quite comprehensive and really look at a variety of factors, and that is everything from, and I want to be clear, there really are two various studies here. One is straight decommissioning. The other is more of a management study that is around, tied to the same general theme, but it looks, one is looking at more operational factors, staffing issues, those sorts of things. And some of that's tied to our existing labor contracts. We are required to do some of that in the closure of a facility like this. Second, the decommissioning would really look at the what's included in that property, what's its value, what cleanup might be required to be done around that. Studying the issues related to bonding dollars that where we have active bonds being paid at that facility. So all of those factors would be considered in that decommissioning study. But then really it is about looking at, you know, what is the potential future use of that site and so forth. The management study really, again, these are tied together, but that really is also focuses on issues related to employment, employees, where they go, where services are offered, and those sorts of elements.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Schnell, can you give the committee some assurance and the people in the room, maybe and the public, some assurance that you will have places for these prisoners to go? They're not going to be out walking the streets, but you will have beds for them.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Scott, yes, that is what this plan is and includes. This is a comprehensive plan. While, you know, this is challenging and comes at a difficult time in terms of, you know, the rollout of this, at the same time, recognizing the facility, its needs, and the state system, and really recognizing this is a national issue. We can look at states across the nation and the federal government that the closure of facilities is a significant reality and largely dependent upon a variety of factors. One of those factors is the aging infrastructure in and of itself. Second is the ability of correctional agencies to deliver on mission, to make sure that the services are delivered and we're not simply warehousing people, which we know has a net negative effect on outcomes. And third, you know, we are seeing, if we begin to look at the history of sentencing, even in Minnesota, we have seen changes, and this is largely tied to, while we've had upticks, we've had overall reductions in crime over the last 30 years, and that is driving some of the numbers that we're seeing. So these are facts that are factors in this, and this is not unique to Minnesota.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Lance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had some conversations about how to craft the language that's in the 839 amendment, and we struggled with it. We struggled for some of the reasons that Mr. Bruce and Mr. Vogel stated in their testimony, which was that this seems to be coming up pretty fast and feels kind of like putting the cart before the horse, that at least partial closure is going to take place before any of these studies are done. Which is supposed to give the guidelines for how we do it, or how the Department of Corrections does it. And while I think the language in the 839 amendment is broader than some earlier versions of it. I think it's taken into consideration some of the priorities and inputs from folks like our MAPA and AFSCME representatives. It still feels somewhat inadequate. And, you know, this was as much a surprise to me as it was, I think, to this committee until shortly before it became public. And so I guess I wonder, Commissioner, if you could give some meaningful response to the concerns raised by the representatives of the workers in the correctional facilities. I'm not going to repeat what they said. You were in the room and you heard it, and I'd be interested in your response to that.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Latz, absolutely. I had the opportunity, not an easy opportunity, to be at Stillwater yesterday morning to meet with the facility leadership first, the union leadership, and then 100-plus employees, and that was certainly not an easy conversation. I would also say that you know, as we look at the phase closure and the notion of the horse before the cart, I think, or the cart before the horse, I should say, it's late. The reality is that when we begin to think about this, that phase closure is really using existing capacity within the system. So the issues that are being raised by by the unions is understandable, and that is really around the impact on workforce, and you know, one of the things we've heard, and I heard directly from some of the staff at the facility, we heard it tonight, is that, you know, why hasn't the department come forward with all of the plans and the implications on workforce that will be or could be affected by this. And one of the realities in the answer, the challenge in giving an answer to that is grounded in the very essence of the agreements that the state has with labor unions. And that is that we come to the table when decisions like this are made, and we initiate a process of talking about the how this begins to happen. And I understand the notion that that may feel like, why do that now? Why weren't we talking about this months ago, a year ago, 10 years ago? And potentially those are all fair questions. The position we find ourselves in today is that the collective bargaining agreements require us to do labor management discussions about how the staffing and staff reductions would be handled going forward. And that's really what has to happen. So the ability for the agency to give a response is really grounded in the fact that we need to have labor management discussions that are required by virtue of our agreements to occur in terms of determining exactly how that happens and what those impacts will be.
Senator Latz.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Schnell, the handwriting's been on the wall for many years. I don't think there's anyone in the room that can really honestly deny that. The facility is in terrible shape. I took a tour there a long time ago, and you still got single pane glass in there, so it's antiquated. And the cost of renovating it would be prohibitive. But given that, we've known this was coming for a long time, it surprises to me that all of a sudden it was sprung upon us by leadership floating this idea and then coming right out with it without the whole statutory scheme that was contemplated happening first. I understand we're looking for money anywhere we can find it in a really tight budget, and this is going to save money, and I've got no quarrel with that. And at some point, there's going to be a leap of faith that we're going to have to trust that the manner in which this closure occurs is going to be one which is not going to put the staff at risk and which is not going to endanger inmates in inmate-on-inmate conflict. And, you know, I don't know the details of, you know, where double bunking is happening, where there are more or less secure wings of which facilities that you'll be able to put people in. I know it's going to be very disruptive for the 1,200 inmates who live within a social structure now, which is going to be completely disrupted and somewhere integrated into another existing social structure in another facility or multiple other facilities. So that's all going to be very disruptive, and it would have been much better to have all that planning occur openly, publicly, with stakeholder input, and especially the input of the unions ahead of time. So I'm not happy with this process either. I agree in the ultimate outcome. And I guess it's going to be incumbent upon the legislature to exercise our legislative branch prerogative to not completely defer to the executive branch, just to say, we're done with it now. Once we pass this, you go do your thing. I, for one, want to receive updates and input, whether it's an interim hearing or whether I'd rather not wait until next January or February to find out, you know, where things are happening. I'd rather not read it on the front page of the Star Tribune either. So I'm hoping that we will get regular legislative input, even if we don't put formal reports in here. Because if we put a formal report in here, we know we're going to get a fiscal note on that for $16,000 or $19,000, and we'll be told we have to pay for it, that the agency can't absorb that either, which is exactly what we've heard from this agency as we were working through our own fiscal budget here, which to me is just ridiculous. I'm just being very candid with you. Maybe it's late and I'm letting some of the guard down, but when we were told we need input, we need information, we need you to absorb a $13,000 bed cost on something, and we were told, nope, got to pay for it. And then we were asked for an additional position above and beyond the agreement, and we were told, you can't absorb that, $161,000. So that's why you're not getting the extra position, or why DPS isn't getting the extra position in the BCA. Because not only did they force us to live within their means, but they wanted us to exceed their means, the agreement that they reached. So I guess I'm expecting more. And I'm expecting input and information. I expect that the unions that represent the workers are going to get the same information and consideration as this process moves forward. Rather than just surprising everyone here with 3 days to go and a constitutional deadline with an agreement that says you got to do this and here's how. So I look forward to receiving those reports without a bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Other members, Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I will be short because everything has pretty much been eloquently covered already. But Commissioner Snell, I echo most importantly what Senator Last said about this is something I've spoken on the floor for years that we need to look at. And right now, all we have is a plan for shutting down that, as Senator Last also said, we had no input in and had little consultation. And there was no time for modifying or taking input. My question for you is, or my request of you is that at some point, I feel in about a year that we will be in the same situation and we'll be asking for operating adjustment. And as also Senator Last said, we better have a plan. And the plan better not be right now just what else we're going to shut down. 2 years ago when I had this discussion with other representatives, it was the discussion of at some point 120 some years ago, someone made the decision, the hard decision, that we would need to build modern facilities at St. Cloud and Stillwater, and those modern facilities are now the antiquated facilities. At what point are we going to move forward, and instead of just talking about shutting down, acquiring modern facilities, giving this staff that works so hard and is it put at such risk, at what point are we going to have a plan to give these staff members working conditions that they deserve in this century? That's also something that we should not wait until next session to start. I think this is something that we should definitely be working on the interim. I would hope that we do that. And also to echo the fact, I hope we don't get hit for a fiscal note for that too.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Other members? All right, Chair Moeller.
I think we're still on the motion, but yes, since others are making comments now, I will too. And I'll just say that this process is not ideal for any of us at this table at all. It's been very difficult to go about this way. But I will also say, the comment about finding the missing money to be able to fully fund the operating adjustment, just in the situation we're in now and the inability to raise revenue that I think some of us would probably be willing to explore isn't feasible. In this session, and I just want to remind folks that, when we came into the budget this year, we had the operating adjustments for the public safety side of things. The ask was $116 million, and our initial target was $50 million. And when we tried to prioritize that money how we really wanted to, we were really slammed by the agencies because of the inability to fund the operating adjustment. And what that meant was we were going to be laying off a lot of staff across the Department of Corrections, a lot of staff across the Department of Public Safety. It meant we weren't going to be able to process evidence in a timely fashion, which is bad for the justice system and for people who are charged with crimes and for victims of crimes. So I just want to put that in perspective that I'm not excusing the process here at all, but I just want people to realize that if we didn't fund the operating adjustment, that has really dire consequences for the staff and for public safety in the state. So thank you.
All right. So if there's no more discussion on the amendment and no more questions for the commissioner, thank you, Commissioner. Chair Moeller was going to renew her motion that to pass the A39 amendment with the incorporated change. So all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails. And the A39 is adopted. Chair Novotny, you have a motion.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I would like to offer an oral amendment to the Task Force on Mandatory Minimums on R38A2, Senate language, page 41. After line 11, insert one retired district court judge appointed by the Chief Justice, and then renumber the clause in order. The House accepted this task force language from the Senate, which is supported by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, but felt it should be included so we get the perspective of someone that the aforementioned retired district court judge who at one time was required to impose mandatory minimum sentences. And we also requested that the Chief Justice do it so that the Chief Justice would be familiar with who is actively filling in and subbing as a retired judge and who is not. And that is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Chair Novotny. So staff has the oral amendment, I'm sure, and is there any discussion to the oral amendment? All right, seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And then, Chair Letts, did you have another motion?
Madam Chair, I'm told that I do.
I'm told you do also.
I just have to read some handwriting here. Madam Chair, I move to adopt Article 4, R9, House Language, lines 40.24 to 40.31. Delete the last sentence and insert the following. Parens lowercase b, the authority granted in this section expires on June 30, 2027. Members of the public, this is the Department of Public Safety grant language that was suggested by the agency upon a review of earlier suggestions. So this deals with the 5% grant amounts that can be retained for named grants and 10% that can be retained for competitive grants to cover the cost of administering the grant, but also limits the application for that to the two-year cycle of this biennium and sets us up for reviewing that whole structure as we move forward, and applies only to this grant program or this grant cycle and existing grants in the pipeline with this agency and not any more broadly than that.
All right. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, I don't believe that I have that language. That must be, does staff have that?
Yeah, I just wrote it.
You just wrote it out. Okay.
From staff, so they have it.
From staff, so staff has the language. Yeah. So
we believe the council has the language, Madam Chair.
Okay, all right. Could we just, because the committee does not have it, could I just have you, if you would, read it one more time? Chair Latz.
Members, if you turn to Article 4, R9, you can follow along. Lines 40.24, dealing with grants, grant contracts and programs administrative costs. The amendment is to delete the last sentence and insert B, the authority granted in this section expires on June 30, 2027. Maybe I can just ask counsel for a little clarity myself, if I may.
Please.
Madam Chair. Where does the last sentence begin? On what line?
The last line.
So we see the amendment. Is it line 40.31? There's a sentence that begins there that goes on to the next lines, page 41, or is it the last sentence of that subdivision, which begins on line 41.1.
Ms. Primo.
Madam Chair and members, this is not my issue area, so I can check in with Public Safety Council, but they were looped in on the email from DPS, I'm fairly certain, but I will get back to you.
Okay, so Madam Chair.
Senator Lance.
Maybe I can ask a representative from DPS that sent us the language that can give us the information.
It's this, without that, just that.
Can we hand out?
Yeah.
These copies. Okay, so this did not include the correct reference to our side-by-sides. So I'm going to direct members to, we're going to hand out the amendment, the A45, so you can see it, Madam Chair.
Please, yeah.
But for reference, this is going to be an Article 2, R40.
Okay.
Now let's take a look and see if that lines up. Where's page 43?
And then you're deleting the current.
That's
the
problem.
Yeah.
Article
2,
page 40.
Okay. 40. That's right.
Senate language. There's no Senate language on that page.
Yeah, the Senate language is on the left on this. So I think it's your right here, yes?
Page 43.
There's line 21.
After line 21.
I don't know why it's
this process for retro.
Chair Mohler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the language that is already in the House language, paragraph A that was handed out, is in the House language, in the House bill. The only thing we're doing here is adding paragraph B, which is essentially a sunset of the language that's in the House side by side.
Okay, so do you know where that language, where that new sunset should live in the side-by-side? Ms. Primo.
Madam Chair and members, my understanding is that the language that's going to go into the conference committee report is what is in the A45. So the piece that Chair Latz read would replace lines 115 and 116 of the A45. And it's because this provision is being added to the Senate language, and it's not currently in the Senate side by side. So they're taking the House language. That's what it looks like in the amendment.
Okay. So does everyone have the A45 amendment then? And okay.
Okay, so there's nothing here. So we're adding section 22.
So does everyone then understand what we're doing now? I think I do. So are there any questions to the amendment? I kind of want to just make sure that it's stated clearly, because also I think the public needs to understand what we're doing. And do we need testimony then, members from DPS? I don't think we really do.
Okay, I see. That's what we're doing now. Okay. I think I'm seeing it now, Madam Chair.
All right. So, Senator Latson, since it's your motion, do you feel like you can make a clear statement of what we're doing here?
Yeah, I think I can, Madam Chair. In the side-by-sides that we've all been working off of, on page R40A2, on the left side, there is Senate language, but you'll notice there's not a section 22. There's only a section 21. So the A45 amendment at that space adds a section 22, which is the underlined language in the A45 amendment. But the A45 amendment itself needs to be changed, which is why on line 15, what's itemized as paragraph B, the language there is deleted and replaced with the handwritten language on the bottom of the A45 that was handed out. That's the sunset language. And then the last part of the A45 amendment goes on into our side-by-sides in Article 4 on page R9. There's a section 9 that deals with grant contracts. That's all being deleted because it's being replaced with what's earlier on the A45 amendment.
Okay. And had we already adopted that other language?
No, none of this has been adopted yet, Madam
Chair. Because normally we don't need to delete language. It's in a side-by-side. We just don't adopt it.
But it's on the same line.
Oh, okay. All right, but staff feels this is clear the way it's written.
Crystal.
And maybe we'll use our corrections bill after all. Who knows? All right. Hope everyone understands what we're doing here.
Yeah.
All right. Very good. So with that, Senator Latz renews his motion to adopt the A45 with the change that we are incorporating, right? Which
That's
is
correct,
to
Madam Chair.
Strike the language on lines 1.15 and 1.16 and replace it with B, the authority granted in this section expires on June 30th, 2027. Correct? All right. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay. All right. So we have reached the magic moment.
Oh, I think I have another amendment.
Oh, you have another amendment. Okay. Senator Latz. We have not reached the magic moment.
Article 2, R24. Well, I'm going to look at I'm going to look at this before I make the motion, Madam Chair. Article 2.
I'm a no on principle.
R24. Madam Chair, Senator Westland, this amends my e-trace language, so
okay.
I hope you might reconsider your
position. I will reconsider.
All right. Now I know what this amendment is doing, and I'd like to make my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Please make your motion.
Madam Chair, I move that the Senate language in Article 2, R24, lines 27.21 to 27.25, be stricken. And so, members, this amendment deals with the e-trace system. And a portion of the e-trace system that required the ballistic testing of all shell casings was what created the fiscal cost for this bill. And that fiscal cost was a lot and not absorbable by the department. So the amendment here deletes the lines that created that fiscal cost by mandating ballistic testing of all shell casings.
All right.
And I'm sorry, expended. We'll use Chair Novotny's language. Expended shell casings.
All right. And Senator, could you repeat the lines that you mentioned that you're striking here?
Lines 27.21 to 27.25 in Article 2, R24.
Okay. So this is to language
the Senate language
we previously adopted,
yeah.
Correct? Okay. So has everyone been able to locate the language and understands what we're doing here? Okay, so we're on Article 2, R24. We are deleting lines 27.21 to 27.25 to take care of a cost. All right, all in favor of the motion as stated by Senator Latz, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion prevails. Are there any other motions? Anybody want to change anything else right now? Okay. All right. So maybe the magic moment has arrived then. So I will move adoption of the agreed upon spreadsheet that is before us. And then from this, I think the staff, I'm sure they're already preparing it, but they will prepare the appropriations article. So, any discussion to adoption of the spreadsheet? All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the spreadsheet is adopted. And then finally, I move to direct nonpartisan staff to prepare a conference committee report that incorporates the adopted spreadsheet, and that nonpartisan staff are empowered to make technical and conforming changes to the language approved by this conference committee in order to reflect the intent of the members. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Is there any other business before this conference committee? Since it's
closing remarks.
Okay, Senator Letts. Okay, please.
Madam Chair, I just want to take a moment to leave some closing thoughts here. First of all, I really want to express my appreciation to our amazing staff. We don't thank them often enough. And they are absolutely stunning in the kind of work that they do, the support they give, the information they gather for us as we're trying to make decisions here, and what they do to follow up as well, to implement the decisions that we make, and the patience they show when we change our minds or head off in different directions. And so I want to say that. Number two, I want to say how much of a pleasure it has been to work with my conferees. For some, this is the first time through the conference committee process, and certainly as chairs in this field. And I have to say this has been one of the most productive and fruitful and problem-solving oriented conference committees I've ever served on. And that's because of who's a part of it, the staff and the members. So I wanted to say that publicly. I appreciate the work that we all did and the attitude that we all brought to the work that we did. I think the results, especially under difficult circumstances and tight constraints and with some policy challenges, I think we've come to the best place that we could have and better than I imagined when we first came in. So I want to express my appreciation and thoughts there. In terms of sort of moving forward a little bit, I do want to say that there are some pieces of this budget that I would have liked to have seen be better in terms of funding levels. There are a lot of those, but particularly with crime victim services and armor radios. I had a proposal and I've introduced a bill to take what are perennial funding issues for us. Every budget cycle, we're scrambling. And we saw it again here to try to come up with as much money as we can, and we always fall short of the need. I've got a proposal to add fees onto phone lines in Minnesota. 50 cents a line per month, $6 per line per year. We raised $36 million that could, in my proposal, could have been split evenly between victim services at $18 million a year and armor radios replacement at $18 million a year. Would have gone into a special revenue account, would have been long-term stable funding. And for the armor radios, we got a $250 million shortfall there that we need to find money to help our counties do so emergency services can talk with each other. And we are not going to get there at $1 or $2 or $4 or $5 million a year proposals. We're just never going to get there. So I'm hoping that we can take a more serious look at those options next year. And it would be my intention, because I also know ambulance services, especially in rural Minnesota, are scrambling with the same long-term funding challenges. It would be my intention to probably do a 75 cent per phone line fee proposal that would add another long-term funding stream to support ambulance services in greater Minnesota. So I wanted to kind of lay that out publicly. I hope people will take a serious look at it, and I think it's a fiscally responsible and a meaningful way to address these and get it out of the biennial budget battles. The last thing I'm going to propose and ask is that we get together as a joint committees, or at least the public safety side of things, because of the Department of Corrections is in the public safety side, that we have a joint hearing in September to see how the Stillwater prison closing process is going, get an update. And I'd be honored to conduct that jointly with my House counterparts. And with that, thank you for all the work that everyone's done.
Thank you. Chair Mueller, did you want to make a statement? Okay.
Just one. Please don't. I just want to say there were some policy things that fell out of the bill, and it wasn't because they weren't bad policies, but there was because of the time we took with language. As Chair Latt said, on a lot of things, we were very collaborative and worked through a lot of language issues. The coercion was one of those examples, and in fact, a couple of us today were just talking about how we were really already thinking about ways to improve that for next year. So I just want people to know that if policy fell out of the bill and it doesn't necessarily mean it was bad policy, that there are many items that we want to continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And much like what Chair Mueller just said, there are some things that didn't get included this year. I think there are some things that we've agreed to hear next year and have a full vetting of several items. And I look forward to that. And it's been a pleasure to be on the conference committee and serve with all of you. And it was a really great experience, given, we had not a lot of decisions, fewer decisions than maybe normally we would have had because of the budget constraints.
Yeah. Chair Novotny?
Hey, Chair Liebling, Senator Latz brought up his points on funding options, and we did have optional sources of revenue that we pointed out, but the House position was solid on that, and we stayed with the House position on fiscally going forward. We've got a bigger fiscal clip coming up in the next biennium, and I feel that as hard as these cuts that we had to make this year are, they're going to be harder if we didn't make them going forward. So hopefully things can be turned around and we don't have to decide which gets cut next time we have this discussion in 2 years. I hope that in 2 years things have turned around and we can start making real adjustments and making real improvements. This is my first conference committee, and I'd like to say it was productive, but it's with a heavy heart when you realize that hundreds of lives will be affected by the decisions that were made. People will be getting displaced or having to change where they work, and that will have an effect on everyone. So that is not an easy decision to make. So it was not made lightly, but given the short time that we had and the limited resources available to us, then we had no option. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you. And I, even though these folks are chairs, but I want to give anyone, any other members, an opportunity if anyone has any words. Senator Uma Verbeten.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Definitely want to echo thanks to all of the conferees for working together and our staff who are absolutely amazing. I just want to focus my comments on crime victim services, and I am grateful for the work that we did get done here, but do just want to acknowledge the constraints given the deal that was made. It's already difficult with the federal cuts that we're facing right now and with the budget that we had, but with the direction we were given, not only just the operating adjustments, which I completely understand, but the requirements to fund that at the same level as other grant programs that I just don't think are under attack in the same way. There are shelters that are facing closure. There are entire counties that will not have advocates. That, this is a crisis. And I'm signed on to Senator Latz's bill, and I hope we can keep working on finding that long-term solution, but our crime victims deserve better.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right. Well, I would just echo Chair Latz's thanks to the staff and to all the members. It really, this is my first time in this particular role, And it really has been enjoyable. And so just on a personal level, working with all of the staff and members, it's really been a great pleasure and very productive. I think a lot easier bill, honestly, than some have done in the past in the health area. I know it seems very challenging, even, you know, but different kind of challenging. But it's really been a great pleasure working with everyone. And I just kind of wondering, does anyone want to go home tonight? We're just having so much fun here. But seeing as, like, I think I get the last word, I'm just going to say the meeting is adjourned.